Okay, we're going to be going through theology proper. Theology proper. Now, all theology means is the study of God. That's all theology means. Now, that'll probably show up on a test. So theology is just the study of God. It comes from two Greek words, theos, the Greek word for God, and logos, the Greek word for word, hence the idea of study. So it's the study of God. Now, in theology, there's many different branches of theology. You've got areas like anthropology, which is the study of man. Anthropos is the Greek word for man. You've got hamartiology. You don't have to write these down, by the way. These won't be on the test. Hamartiology, which is the study of sin. Hamartia, the Greek word for sin. Soteriology, which is soteria, the Greek word for salvation. So you got different branches of theology. So when you study God theology, when you do theology, you have to study those aspects about God, such as the things He does. And part of what He did was creation, what He created, and His response to free beings that make free choices, such as angels and humans. And so you've got all sorts of branches of theology connected with the study of God that isn't directly studying God, but it's studying beings He created or things like that. Well, when we want to study, when we want to do theology but center it on the study of God, they just call that theology proper. So the field of theology is the study of God, and it entails not only the study of God, but the study of what God has made, the study of God's creation. But when we talk theology proper, we're talking the study of God, period. Okay? So we really want to zero in on the nature of God, the attributes of God, and things of that sort. So that's basically what theology is, the study of God, and theology proper is the study of God, period. Not just what God's dealings with His creation, but the study of God, period. Now, in this course, theology proper, obviously it's the doctrine, the biblical doctrine of God that we're going to be studying. We're going to spend a lot of time not only talking about what God is like, but we're going to talk about what God is not like. And that's the first section that we're going to be covering in theology proper, is worldviews. The Christian view of God is called theism, Christian theism. Well, when we look at worldviews, we're going to look at the non-theistic views of God, okay? So just remember, I'll define theism after we give an overview. What's that?
A contradiction.
What's that?
The non-theistic view of God. The non-God view of God.
Well, yeah, and it's the thing is, theism is a type of God. It's not just God. But it's actually a type of God, because there's like pantheism, and we'll get into that. We'll go over the different views of God. The New Agers today, they are not taught, when they say God, they mean something totally different from what we mean by God. We're a creation of the biblical God. They are their God. It's a whole different thing. We'll talk about that later on in this lecture. But we'll talk about different worldviews other than the Christian worldview and why they don't hold any water. Then we'll give arguments for the God of the Bible, which is called basically the theistic arguments. Theistic arguments. John, because you have so many courses in philosophy and a few courses in theology, a lot of this stuff you're going to recognize from other lectures. An awful lot of it. So we're going to cover the other worldviews, and then we're going to present arguments for the Christian worldview. And this is like an overview of the whole course. So as we start analyzing each thing and picking it apart, you'll see what kind of progress we're making. Now, the main objection to the God of the Bible, the the God of Christian theism is the problem of evil. So we're going to, number three, take a look at the problem of evil. If God is all good and all powerful, why in the world would he allow evil? And does evil disprove God's existence? So we're going to take a look at that. After that, we're going to be looking at God's nature, who God is, try to explore it a little bit, and we're going to spend a little bit of time on what's called immanence and transcendence. Immanence, by the way, in this outline, really look, when you study over your notes for the test, really look at that outline, because if it's on the outline, you know it's going to be on the test. The world views, each one of those separate world views, you're going to at least have to be able to identify them on the test. I won't ask you to refute them. If it was a philosophy course, or especially philosophy of religion, that's where we spend more time refuting that type of thing. But if it's in this outline, you know it's important enough to be on the test. But immanence means the fact that God is involved with the universe. Immanence, God is involved with the universe. And transcendence means that God transcends the universe. In other words, God is above or separate from the universe. Okay? And when we look at the worldviews, we'll talk about that as well. Dr. Mike McKenzie, in his class on the worldviews, does a magnificent and unique job with immanence and transcendence. I really like the way he uses that. Because it's really important. What makes the Christian theistic God, he's a personal God, we're going to see that, not an impersonal force like the God of pantheism, but he's also immanent, but he's transcendent. The pantheistic God is immanent. He's involved with the universe. We'll get to that when we get to it, but he's involved with the universe because he is the universe, but he's not transcendent. He's not separate from the universe. Whereas in Christianity, he's both involved with the universe, but he's also separate from the universe. He's not identical with it. So we'll talk about God's nature and immanence and transcendence. We're going to probably do a few lectures on the doctrine of the Trinity. Now, like I said, you don't have to be able to refute. You've got to be able to identify other worldviews by the time this course ends. But you do not have to. You don't need to pass this course, you don't need to be able to refute these other worldviews. But one thing you better know before you get out of this course, and you'll be tested on it, is the doctrine of the Trinity. I mean, you cannot take theology proper, a theology proper course, and say you know the course, and then come out of it with a faulty view of the Trinity. Now, what I'm not saying you're going to come out of this class fully understanding the Trinity. If anything, I will try to show you that you and I probably know a lot less about the Trinity than we think we know. God's nature is so far above our nature. His infinite nature is so far above our finite, limited natures that we're never going to fully understand him. We're going to learn more about him throughout all eternity, and we'll never have him fully figured out. At the same time, there are basic principles that are about God, basic truths about God that give us the doctrine of the Trinity. And we can know that. It's basically that there is only one true God, but this one true God exists throughout all eternity as three separate co-equal persons, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. We'll spend some time talking about that. That doctrine has been butchered, maligned, over and over again throughout church history. And you just can't say, well, I did real well in my theology proper course. I just couldn't figure out what was meant by the word Trinity. Well, no, you've got to get that down pat, the threeness of God and the oneness of God. After we discuss the doctrine of the Trinity, we'll spend several lectures on that, as I mentioned. We'll talk about the names of God. The names of God. In the Hebrew, basically we'll cover mainly the Hebrew names of God. We'll go into some of the Greek names of God, Theos and Kurios. But I really want to spend the bulk of our time on the names of God and the Hebrew names of God. The Hebrews, to name something was to describe it. That's the way the Hebrews were. They didn't just, you know, throw around names just for the heck of it. And some of the names of God are beautiful concepts about God. Now we're going to spend two or three lectures, probably three, on the attributes of God. The attributes of God is basically the characteristics of God. God is good, God is holy, God is love, God is gracious, God is righteous. So you want to spend a few lectures on that. Now, by the way, the textbooks that are required for this course, if you're a Farriston student, like you, John, it's Miller J. Erickson, all the chapters dealing with the study of God, okay, what God is like and what God does, that type of thing. Then you also have to read Our Idea of God by Morris, because here's a Notre Dame philosopher who happens to be a born-again Christian who is really heavy into philosophy, a great thinker, but he's moving away from Thomas Aquinas and from Augustine and some of their views about God, their traditional views about God throughout history. And what I want to do is show that he may be right in some areas at the same time. Don't be too quick to throw out the Thomistic or Augustinian baby with the Augustinian and Thomistic bathwater, because some of the reasons why Aquinas and Augustine held to the views that they held about God was for two reasons. Number one, it was biblical, and number two, it was the only possible answer to certain philosophical dilemmas. And if people follow Tom Morris and Ronald Nash and a few of these other philosophers, Christian philosophers, we're going to basically run smack into things like Zeno's paradox and all kinds of philosophical dilemmas that were answered by Augustine and Aquinas. But I want us to read, when you read Morris, read him close, because there's some areas where I don't agree with him, but he encourages dialogue. You read it and he makes you think, and that's what I want us to do. I want us to do some thinking in this course. If you're working on a certificate in Christian ministry, then the basic reading textbook is Charles Ryrie, Basic Theology. Real solid. Right? You can't go wrong with Ryrie. I disagree with him on a few points, but they're not essential points. Ryrie is about as conservative of an evangelical as you can get, and that's why I like Ryrie. And then also you'll be reading Our Idea of God, and that's the one that you want to, when you read it close, and if you have questions, write them down in the textbook, and we can dialogue on that when we get to that point. But we'll talk about the attributes of God. For instance, I'll just throw this out. Does God exist in time, or does God exist in eternity, which is outside of time? That's a big thing. Aquinas and Augustine said God exists outside of time and eternity, but he can still act in time. When he created the first changing thing, time began. But Morris and Ronald Nash and others are saying, no, God exists in everlasting time. But we're going to see that to hold that view, to say that God experienced moment by moment existence, existing in time, and time is everlasting, we're going to find out that view, you'll end up with a whole lot of dilemmas that create a lot of problems. And we shouldn't throw out all the thinking that Aquinas and Augustine did just because we're being pressured by a few theologians who happen to be apostatizing. Morris isn't apostatizing, Nash isn't apostatizing, But the guys that are pressuring this type thing, a lot of them are. And I think one guy who's on the way out is Clark Pinnock. But that's a whole other story. Nice guy, real nice guy. Met him in San Francisco. Great guy, but I think he's his daughter's, like I told Douglas Grotheis, Pinnock's daughter's slowly sliding off the throne. How does God reveal himself? We're going to talk, number eight, we're going to talk about divine revelation, how God reveals himself. Okay? And basically two ways. There's natural revelation, that's God revealing himself through nature. The invisible God has revealed his existence through that which is visible, nature, that which he created. And God also put his moral laws on our conscience. This is all from Romans 1 and Romans 2 and Psalm 19. So God revealed himself through nature. That's natural revelation. But he also reveals himself through miracles, through Jesus, and through the Bible. That's supernatural revelation. Okay? And so we'll probably spend one lecture talking about that. Number nine, we want to talk about God and creation. The Bible teaches God created everything out of nothing. Plato, his Demiurgos, his God created everything out of pre-existing matter. In other words, the world already existed, but it was without form, and God kind of designed it, but it already existed. Not so with the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible didn't take pre-existing matter and form it into something else. He created it out of nothing. Okay? Certain pantheists believe that all creation emanated from God, so God created it out of himself. But the Bible teaches that God created everything out of nothing. And so we'll look at that when we get to that point. And then point number 10, divine sovereignty and human free will. So many different courses touch on this. We're just going to briefly touch on it in our final lecture. God is in control. I believe, now not all theologians agree with me on this, but I believe that the Bible teaches that God is sovereign, God is in control, but man is free. And how do we reconcile God being in complete control, yet at the same time, man has free will? And so we're going to look into that. Now those are the 10 things. Now, the way I look at it, there's going to be some of these. I'd like to cover the first three tonight. I think we should be able to do it, because I don't want to go too in-depth on them. But the only ones, just as a basic general statement, I think every one of these 10 points we can cover in one lecture or less, except for the Trinity is going to need at least two more lectures, and the attributes of God is going to need at least two more lectures. So right there we're looking at between... Some of them will take less than a lecture, so we're looking at between 12 and 14 lectures probably on this course. So that's what I'd like to do. So it's about a 7-week course. And the tests, you take them in your own time. It gets kind of hard for me to touch bases with everybody, so what I'll probably do is probably trust a guy's wife to sign the test and stuff like that, and oversee him taking the test and stuff like that, so I can do that with you, Lucky. And I did that with Gary Tronson, had his wife Pam oversee him taking the test. It cuts out classroom time and that type of thing. There's usually not as much discussion time during the classes as with a normal college course, and that cuts things down greatly too. And the advantage for the guys that go to my church is they can ask me the questions at church after Sunday or throughout the week at a Bible study. What you'll have to do is give me a ring on the phone if you got some questions and that type of thing. But we try to really condense all the information. We've got another professor with the Institute, Dr. Mike McKenzie, who teaches in a more traditional style, and about 40 to 45 hours of classroom time usually fills up less time on cassettes than what I do in 14 lectures and stuff like that. So I've been able to get a full college course worth of material and cut it down just by not talking about the Seahawks or whatever. I'm not saying traditional style is bad, but just from what I know of our students and how valuable time is, and my job and how valuable my time is, we try to go with the condensed courses, and our students are a lot more mature than the college students coming right out of high school, and it usually works. But we're looking at 10 to 14, or 12 to 14 lectures, and so now what we need to do is to look at worldviews. And all this is the study of God. We want to look at the God of the Bible and see who He is, what He's like. We're going to try to do the impossible, define God. Obviously, it's going to be a weak definition. In fact, let me give you that right at the start of the course. Let me give you a definition of God, and we'll kind of work into it, and it'll start out. We'll start out without a great understanding of it, but as time goes on, it'll become more and more clear. This is the definition of God now. And I want you to write this down word for word. This is what the God of the Bible is defined as. Now, we're not even going to get into the Trinity yet, okay? We're just talking about the nature of God. We're not even going to get into the Trinity yet. We'll get to that a little later. But basically, God is the self-conscious personal being. God is the self-conscious. He is conscious. He's conscious of His own existence, okay? God is the self-conscious personal being. So, number one, you know He's self-conscious. He's not an impersonal force that doesn't think. He has self-consciousness. He's a self-conscious being. Number two, He's a personal being. Okay, so He's not an impersonal force like the God of pantheism or the God of the New Age movement. God is the self-conscious personal being who is the uncaused cause of all that exists. God is the self-conscious personal being who is the uncaused cause of all that exists. Obviously, all that exists other than Himself. He didn't cause His own existence because He's uncaused. So He always was. And to say God is, if we say God is self-caused, that's a fallacy. Because for something to be self-caused, it would have to pre-exist its own existence in order to cause its own existence to come about. So God is not self-caused, He is uncaused. So God is the self-conscious personal being who is the uncaused cause of all else that exists and who transcends the whole creation so He is above and separate from creation and who transcends the whole creation while being immanent in it or to it. While being immanent, either in it or to it. Either one I'd accept. Get a grammarian here, we find out that we're right. Okay, so definition of God. God is the self-conscious personal being who is the uncaused cause of all else that exists and who transcends the whole creation while being immanent in it. So in other words, He's separate from the creation, but He's also involved with it. We're going to see with this immanence and transcendence where false views of God usually put too much weight on one view and not enough weight on another view.
Where did you get this
from? Basically, it's a working definition. I don't know I don't even remember if I don't think I took it word for word from somebody. The uncaused cause aspect sounds more like what I got out of philosophy. I've been working with these notes for a long time. My guess is it probably from a study of people like Ryrie, the courses that I had under H.L. Wilmington at Liberty University, and Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Morrison at Liberty University. I probably put the whole thing together and took a little from each and took what I liked most. Now, what this does is this separates this particular definition here would classify, would give the same definition of God for the main theistic religions, both Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. As far as theology proper is concerned, the doctrine of God, what's going to separate them, in other words, these three religions would agree on this definition for all practical purposes. That's if they're in classical Judaism and classical Islam or Orthodox Christianity. In other words, they're not liberals within their fields that are throwing their faith away. Where you're going to get the difference in those three, in as far as theology proper, is Judaism and Islam deny the Trinity. They deny that God is more than one person, and one of those persons became a man. One of those divine persons became a man. What we're going to see too, this is what I've done. This definition usually occurs a lot further back, and we first go through the worldviews, and then we argue for God's existence, and then we touch on a few passages about God's nature, and that leads up to it. What I decided to do was give you the results first, so you got that down on paper and you're thinking along those lines, and then we're going to start moving in that direction. Good. If you need to just look at it here. Just get it right off of that, and that'll be fine. Okay. What I want us to do now, I want us to look at worldviews. There's many different worldviews. I'm going to list some on the board so you get the spelling right. And I'm going to define them, and I'm just going to touch on a few problems with each of the worldviews other than theism. Theism is the true worldview. The definition we gave of God is basically the theistic. That's theism. The theistic view of God, a personal God who is separate from the universe but also involved with it, and he caused the universe to come into existence. Christian theism, though, also entails the doctrine of the Trinity, and we'll get to that point a little bit later. But I want us to look at some of the different worldviews. Let me throw some out to you. First, there's skepticism, agnosticism. We're not going to spend too much time on those. There's atheism. We would spend a lot more time, by the way, on worldviews if it was a course on philosophy or philosophy of religion. There's pantheism. There's panentheism, which is just pantheism with just an en after the pan. Panentheism. There's deism.
But my nose back just in time.
There's polytheism. Dualism. Finite godism. And, let's
see, we got polytheism already.
I'll even say henotheism or henotheism, I don't even know how it's pronounced. A lot of these are real overlapping. And we're going to talk about it. So, right there, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. That would make 10 great multiple choice questions on a test, not to give any hints out there, but if you guys are paying attention, get the good one sentence definition of these, because they'll really help out. First off, skepticism very much like agnosticism. Skepticism suspends judgment. If it's complete skepticism, it's supposed to suspend judgment on all things, okay? Of course, the problem with that is if you're a skeptic, you didn't suspend judgment on your suspending judgment. So you're really not a skeptic. You're as dogmatic as anybody else is. But skepticism says suspend judgment on all things. So just put skepticism, put suspends judgment, okay? Now, when it applies to God, you might be like Dr. Peter John, the philosophy professor from Lower Columbia College that I debated on God's existence. He was a skeptic, not on all things, but just on God's existence. Okay? So, and the spiritual realm, okay? So skepticism just suspends judgment on God's existence. It says, we'll never know, or we don't know right now. I'm just going to suspend judgment. I'm not going to make judgment either way. Now, technically speaking, the skeptic, the agnostic, and the atheist, for practical purposes, even though there's some theoretical differences, for practical purposes, they all talk the same talk. For all practical purposes, they're atheists, okay? But a skeptic suspends judgment. The agnostic, and I'm talking about what is called a hard agnostic, but you don't need to know that here. The agnostic, he says that we cannot know about God exists. If God exists, there's no way for us to know. So the agnostic says we cannot know about God's existence. The problem with that is it's self-refuting, because to say that we cannot know anything about God's existence is a claim to know something about God's existence. And that is the fact that we can't know about it. So it self-refutes, it shoots itself in the foot. And same with skepticism says this, we need to suspend judgment on all things pertaining to God. Well, they didn't suspend judgment on their suspending judgment on all things pertaining to God. So that shoots itself in the foot as well. So agnosticism says we cannot know God. So if you want a real short, brief definition, skepticism suspends judgment. Agnosticism, man cannot know God, or we cannot know God. Atheism says it denies God's existence. These others are saying God might exist, but we should suspend judgment on it because we'll never know. Agnosticism says we cannot know if he exists, so he might exist, but we can't know it. Atheism says he definitely does not exist. Okay? And where atheism crumbles is the fact that in order to know that God doesn't exist, you would have to be omniscient, all-knowing. You would have to be omnipresent everywhere at once to be able to search the entire universe, both the physical and the spiritual realm, in case that exists. And basically, the only way to know without a doubt that God does not exist, you would have to be God. You would have to have the attributes, the characteristics of God, to search the whole universe and come back and say there is no God. When the Russian astronauts went to, they're cosmonauts? When they went to outer space, they looked in outer space and they came back and said that we've proven that there is no God. We looked in outer space and he's not there. Well, that's stupid. And the fact is, you can search the entire universe and not find God. And all that shows is there's no God who physically exists within the physical universe, what we know of as the physical universe, which proves absolutely nothing. Yeah, you'd have to be. And the thing is, too, is if you're on Mars, he might be on Venus. So you couldn't just look at each place in the universe only once. You'd have to be everywhere at once. You'd have to be omnipresent. But then you not only have to be omnipresent, you would have to be able to search the entire spiritual realm as well as the physical realm. And you'd have to be basically know everything there is to know. And it's The Christian says it's like there's an infinite number of white ping pong balls and there's one red ping pong ball. And the Christian said, I looked in there and I found the red ping pong ball. I experienced the red ping pong ball. I found God. Well, the atheist has said, no, I've proven there is no red ping pong ball. Well, what do you have to do to prove there's no red ping pong ball? You have to go through every single white ping pong ball, and there's an infinite number of them. You can never do it all. And then the atheist, the only way atheism could be true would be if the atheist was God and had that kind of knowledge and was omnipresent to prove that God doesn't exist, but then the fact is he would be God. So it would disprove his view anyway. And it doesn't prove God's existence. What it does is it proves that God's non-existence cannot be proven. Or to say it different, God's existence cannot be disproven. And right now, almost every atheist that is out there classifies himself as an agnostic
to avoid that.
He recognizes you cannot disprove God's existence. Atheism, the third worldview there. Pantheism is the view that God is the universe. Pantheism, God is or God equals the universe. This is the religion of the Hindus, some Buddhists, though more consistent Buddhists are actually atheists, or at least agnostics. But it's the religion of the New Age movement, Shirley MacLaine and Company. It's the religion of the Hindus. It's the religion of the Christian Scientists, where God equals the universe. God and the universe are one and the same. And since you're part of the universe, you are God. So you can stand on the beach with Shirley MacLaine and scream out, I am God, I am God, I am God. And you can do it till you're blue in the face, but the fact is you ain't God. But pantheism is the teaching that God is the universe. There's tons and tons of problems with pantheism. We don't have a lot of time to go into it. But the fact is that the idea that God is the universe, they believe that God is an impersonal force. God is an it. He's kind of like electricity. Okay? He's not like a personal being like you or I who can love, who can give commands. He's like a force, a power, but he is not a personal being. Well, the fact is, man is personal. Now, the pantheist may deny that man is personal, but when he makes that denial, he's actually proving that he's a personal being. He's reasoning, he's arguing, and so the whole question comes up, can the cause of man be impersonal? Also, can the cause of intelligence, because anybody who argues, if the pantheist argues there is no such thing as intelligence, if he wants to argue that, he has to first make an intelligent statement in order to argue against intelligence. So it's self-refuting, but can the cause of intelligence, intelligent life, be non-intelligent? Can the cause of moral life be amoral? So it doesn't really make sense. Pantheism doesn't really make sense. If the world is really an illusion, like most pantheists say, I mean, the physical world seems to be the most obvious thing to us. If it's just an illusion, how can we be sure of anything? Especially the views of the pantheism. Yeah. So in other words, if I was convinced that the world is an illusion, I'd probably just sit in the corner and starve to death. You just sit there because you couldn't be sure about anything. And you know, the pantheist says the world's an illusion, but he eats three meals a day. And when it rains, he puts an umbrella over his head. He sure lives like the world is an illusion. And he says the world's an illusion, but if you clenched your fist and threw a punch at him, he'd probably block it or duck or get hit with it and scream and then call the cops. But most pantheists, everybody knows, every theist knows pantheists aren't good fighters. You know. but
the abbreviation is pantheist.
Yeah, well, I was talking to Luther College to a pantheist once, and this guy, not only was he a vegetarian, but he was even against eating dairy products. I mean, this guy was living on lettuce.
Why does it matter if the lettuce and the cow are both part of God?
And, yeah, he should eat nothing is what he's going to be consistent. That's exactly right, John. And but this guy was standing there talking to me. I'm 5'5", and I weigh 180. This guy was about, you know, 5'8", and had to weigh, like, maybe, I'll give him some credit, maybe with clothes on, he weighed 103 pounds. I don't know. But all I said was, look, hey, I'll eat what I want to eat. You know, and I like going to McDonald's and Burger King and all. I'll eat what I want to eat. You eat what you want to eat. But I pat him on the back. I said, but don't ever pick a fight with me. Because, you know, this guy, here's a guy who's living on lettuce. And I'll tell you, man, when I was in the Marine Corps, I'd like to know that the guy with, in that foxhole next to me that my life might depend on, I'd like to know that he eats steak at least once a week, you know? But anyway, but with pantheists, the peace, love, and Dan and yogurt people, you know, another problem with pantheism there is, what refutes it is the fact that many beings do exist. You know, they say no, only one being exists. They deny all multiplicity. There are not many beings. There's only one being. But in order to deny my existence, which is what the pantheist is doing, I must first exist in order to make a denial of my existence. I mean, nothing is nothing, nothing does nothing, therefore nothing can deny nothing. So if I deny my existence, I have to exist first to deny it. When I communicate to others, when the pantheist communicates to others, he affirms their separate and individual existence as well. And so, you know, why should we deny what common sense and experience tells us to be true? The pantheist says, denies all multiplicity, and he's trying to convince you, another being, of that view. And so he doesn't live like his view is true. But that's pantheism. Now, panentheism is very close to it. There are some guys that call themselves Christians that are process theologians that are into panentheism, process theology. And that is the view that the universe is God's body. By the way, when I'm talking about these things, is if you remember it, great. It'll help you when you debate these guys, when you bump into them on the street. But the main thing that I want you guys to get out of this is just, you know, atheism, the belief that there is no God. Pantheism, God is the universe. And panentheism, the universe is God's body. That's what you're going to see on a test. That's the, by the way, if you see something on a test of mine, I would like you to know that. I would like you to be able to max out my test 10 years from now. So I'm not going to ask you bogus, non-important things. I'm not trying to trap you on my test. My test, I try to ask you things that I would think you really should know 10 years from now. Now, there's a few things that are, I think, Old Testament survey, a few of the minor prophets, I actually have to break out my notes to correct it, the themes of them. But for the most part, I correct all my tests from memory because it's stuff that I know 10 years after I had it at school, and it's stuff I think guys should know. And by the way, my teachers did not always teach that way. I think it's possible for a student to pick out the most important things from the class and to study it and say, I want to know these things 10 years from now because I'm going to be going into the ministry someday and this is important stuff and I, as a future pastor, need to know this 10 years from now. It's always possible that student is going to get a lousy teacher who asks them a lot of trick questions and a lot of dumb, non-essential things and the guy to get fouled up. Now, I did real well. I had a very, very high average. It was 4.0 until the Persian Gulf War. Then the security job that I had took me off a gate where I could study and made me drive around, maybe work 20 hours of overtime a week, and I ended up pulling four B's and just lost my straight 4.0 average. But I have to admit, I had to cram for exams, and there was a lot of stuff as soon as the exam was over that I said, okay, now get that stuff out of my mind.
because that's not really important. That's just the teacher's little pet peeves, and he was off the wall here, off the wall there, whatever. But like in a book, when you study the book of Romans, 10 years from now, you should be able to sit down and write down numbers 1 to 16 and give me a one sentence or a one phrase overview of each of the chapters of the book of Romans. You're never going to, I can't tell you for the life of me what H.L. Wilmington, when he taught through the book of Romans at Liberty University years ago, what he said about Romans 8, verse 7. I can't tell you off the top of my head. But what I can tell you is that Romans 8 is focused on the fact that those who are truly saved, God keeps them saved, and there's no separation from the love of God to those who are in Christ Jesus. Nothing in the universe can separate us from God's love. And Romans chapter 8 focuses on the glorification of the believer, whereas 6 and 7 focus on the sanctification of the believer. And those are the kind of things that a guy should know. Get with that big overview, then when you analyze it verse by verse and you preach to your people, you're not going to pull verses out of context because you've got a good, solid overview of the book of Romans. And that's the way I think it should be for each and every topic. And getting back to theology proper, panentheism teaches the universe is God's body. The universe is God's body, where basically God is the soul of the universe, that type of thing. And it's real problematic. They have two poles to God, and an actual pole, a potential pole. It's real complex. But basically, God ends up being both finite and infinite. He ends up being both